Welcome to the Elements of Being podcast, where I dissect and explore the minds and habits of psychologists, filmmakers, writers, and industry icons. Essentially, we learn what makes them flip the switch to achieve great feats, goals, and milestones, and a chance to geek out over the psychology behind human behavior. So what is this podcast specifically about? I examine the mental and emotional narratives and processes that have steered writers, filmmakers, psychologists, and industry icons down their paths in life. Each episode is also a glimpse into the trends and patterns of human behavior and the underlying influences that navigate us into different directions. Whether we primarily focus on nutrition or the unconscious, guests share insights, thought-provoking lessons, the nuances of creativity, and the elements of being us. I'm excited to share today's episode with you. From YouTube to Twitter to Instagram, Lauren Toyota has hundreds of thousands of combined followers, fans, and subscribers. She seamlessly transitioned from close to 10 years as television host and producer to an independent, self-made content producer. Every Wednesday, you can find Lauren sharing gourmet vegan comfort food recipes on the Hot for Food YouTube channel that now boasts nearly 473,000 subscribers and over 36 million channel views since launching in February of 2015. Her debut cookbook, Vegan Comfort Classics, 101 Recipes to Feed Your Face, became a bestseller and is available now wherever books are sold. Her second cookbook is set for release in February 2021. Among other accolades, Lauren Toyota was also named Canada's most influential vegan by Impact Magazine in 2017 and one of the powerhouse Canadian women killing it in 2018 by Refinery29. In our interview, we covered everything from the mindset of a host to living with intent. Here's what we specifically discussed: the evolution of Lauren's vegan philosophy, her cookbook, and Hot for Food YouTube channel, managing personal and professional criticisms, how Lauren maintains her genuine connection with the art and science of cooking while serving the professional need to produce weekly, the challenges of managing the line between being genuine and sharing too much of your personal self, being mindful of a growing audience without succumbing to the pressures of it's never big enough, rising above failure, and checking in with your intuition and living with intent. So with this being said, let's jump in. Lauren, thank you for sharing the table with me today.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
My last couple of interviews have been with psychologists about the different facets of mindfulness. And fitting enough, you have quite a practice yourself, one of which I love to dig into. But first, we have so much to examine about your path and mindset that has led to becoming a YouTube phenom in the vegan world, a world that initially introduced me to you. And from your time at MTV to your cookbook, you certainly have kept yourself busy. And you have a number of exciting projects on the horizon, including the Portugal experience in the fall, as well as the launching of a second cookbook in early 2021. My wife, Sammy, and I absolutely love to travel, and we visited Lisbon and Porto with our son, Preston, who was a year old a couple springs ago. At that time, we were incredibly fascinated with the landscape, history, and food. How did you ultimately decide on Portugal as a destination?
Well, my friend Amanda, who runs the Getaway Co., that's the company that I'm partnering with to run a kind of retreat experience that's fully plant-based. She's Portuguese. She grew up in Canada. That's how we know each other. But she recently moved to Switzerland because she has the EU passport. She's been there for about 6 years. When we were planning trips, you know, we did an experience called Live with Purpose Bali, and we did that in 2019. And we planned another Bali one that's been postponed because of COVID. But when we were thinking about doing a second offering in 2020, I don't know, my mind just immediately went to Portugal from hearing her talk about it. And I think she had also emphasized that Portugal was becoming very vegan friendly for tourists. So that was sort of attractive. And I remember hearing a story as well about the Portuguese government mandating vegan options on restaurant menus.
Incredible.
Yeah, I kept my eye on that story, and I don't know where it's at. But anyway, my friend Amanda had just said, you're going to love Portugal. It's coastal. It's beautiful. And I haven't really been to a lot of places in Europe. So it was just sort of attractive to me. And I think sometimes you don't even really know why you want to go somewhere. And then you get there and you're like, oh, I see, you know, the magic here. And there's, you know, sort of discover reasons why you were drawn to it when you're there.
And where do you plan a visit while in Portugal?
We are doing the retreat on the coast in a place called, and I may mispronounce this because I still have to learn. I think it's called Cascais. Do you know that place?
Unfortunately, we don't. Yeah. On our trip, we flew into Lisbon, took a train to Porto, and then jumped over to Madrid. So that's the extent of my knowledge about Portugal.
Yeah, we'll have the sort of villa in that coastal place, but we'll have a day trip into Lisbon, and I believe we have a day trip into Porto as well. So we hope to sort of see different parts of it.
Well, that will certainly be a treat for you and for all of your guests. We certainly hope it still happens with everything going on right now with COVID.
I know. We don't know. You know, we set the date. We kind of just wanted to put it out there and see what kind of response we'd get. I think you have people in one camp who are kind of antsy to get back out and travel. And you have other people who are confused and would rather wait for more information. But, you know, Amanda's going to do the responsible thing. And obviously what she's keeping a very close eye on travel advisories and everything. But because it's in September, you know, we feel like it's best to just go ahead as planned and then make adjustments when we need to, when we know more.
Yeah, no doubt. And my wife and I were taking our family to Spain and Italy about a month ago, and unfortunately, everything was canceled because of COVID. I think those people that feel the connection to travel and the spirit of new environments will definitely return. But right now, it's a test in terms of how far we want to extend ourselves. So we'll be thinking about you guys and hopefully your group in Portugal in the fall.
Yeah, we've had some good response. I'm just trying to stay hopeful, you know, so we'll see.
Well, your blog and videos really show your expanse list of skill sets, interests, and indulgences. You're a producer, a storyteller, host. What do you think defines you best?
Yeah, I like the word creator. And I think with that goes with storytelling. I think working my way through sort of television for almost 10 years, you start to become, I guess, familiar with the idea of storytelling. But it used to kind of intimidate me to label myself as a storyteller. But I think everybody is. I think that's what I've come to realize is that everybody is. We're all experiencing, you know, the ups and downs of life, and everyone has a story to tell, multiple stories to tell. So I think it's just like getting to a place where I can share my experiences is really all I've ever wanted to do. And yeah, I guess, I mean, creator is really it. And that to me applies to everything because, you know, I believe we create our own lives and we create our own experiences and there are lessons within that. So like I am a creative in terms of my business and what I do, but it really does apply to sort of every moment of my life, I think.
And have there been any books that have steered this consciousness the most?
Yeah, I mostly only read books that are nonfiction that are kind of in that realm of self-help or mindfulness and different practices. A book that I read when I was quite young, still in high school, was Seed of the Soul by Gary Zukav. And I think that that book really gave me a framework for, yeah, just a different consciousness or a way of being more aware of something beneath the surface. The idea of having a soul, having a higher consciousness, an awareness of something outside our regular reality or what we call reality. So I think that book really gave me the framework for this whole thing. And it's evolved a lot over time, obviously. That's a big one. And then later in my life, I read The Power of Now, which I think was just a very simple read that puts the idea of being present in perspective and makes it very simple to understand and the benefits of that. And that's by Eckhart Tolle. And those are two books that I always come back to when I don't have the clarity or I don't feel very aligned. I go back to those books and read passages and reminders from them. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about returning to a book because we go through so many experiences in life. A book that you read 10 years ago may have a very different feel it may stir a different perspective, you know, much later on. I do return to some of my favorites. But I'm curious, that first book you mentioned, did someone introduce that book to you, or did you just happen to find it?
Well, that was featured on the Oprah Winfrey Show. And so as a young girl, my mom watched Oprah. We'd watch it after school. And I was always hooked on it. And that's when she started talking about mindfulness, was when she brought Gary Zukav on the show. And my mom bought the book. And then I remember finding it, because I don't know if she finished it, and it was just sitting on the shelf. I don't know when, if I saw him on the show, and then a year later I found the book, but something like that. Some time had passed. My mom had kind of not gone back to the book, and I just took it. And yeah, it pretty much blew me away, and was the first time I had heard anyone speak about, you know, who you really are that way, and with that language.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about your life as a vegan and perhaps how that evolved. And I noticed that you contributed a recipe to Jean Bauer's book, Living the Farm Sanctuary Life. For those people who don't know him, he's the president of Farm Sanctuary. He's also a global animal activist. Was the vegan spirit always so pervasive in your life?
Well, I think somewhere it was. I went vegetarian when I was about 12 or 13. So the idea of eating animals has always been weird to me. That's why I wanted to go vegetarian. I feel an affinity toward animals that I feel is on the strong end. You know, some people don't have an affinity for animals. They can kind of take it or leave it, but I'm just very connected to animals. So I think that is, yeah, the spirit of veganism was always inside of me, but you know, due to society and cultural and social pressures and just the way we're a little bit brainwashed to think about food, I think that took over for a lot of my life, because I stopped being vegetarian when I went to college. And there was always a sort of inner voice in the back of my head being like, you know, you should be vegan. Like, why aren't you vegan? Like, just sort of this little voice. It was always like, you know, you probably would feel better if you were vegan. You shouldn't eat that. You know, but you really can get good at ignoring yourself. So I did that for a long time. And it wasn't until 2009 that I started paying attention to how I felt and started to make those changes.
I don't personally know too many vegetarian 12-year-olds. Was there something at that point that pushed you to reconsider your relationship with food?
I mean, I don't remember like a very pivotal standout moment. Like, it's not like I looked an animal in the eyes and had this epiphany, but I would say, you know, I think at the time you would have called it like an alternative lifestyle, right? And I think this idea of just being different was attractive to me always, and doing what was expected of me was not something I wanted to do. I always wanted to be very defiant. You know, I remember The Simpsons where Lisa Simpson goes vegetarian. Like, maybe that was a pivotal influence, but it was like that, you know, just being more of a renegade, and also the influence of musicians, where musicians are, you know, on the fringe and they're always alternative and doing different things. And I think vegetarianism really was part of that scene. And I was influenced by all of that because I was really into music when I was a young, you know, teenager. And so I think that was probably the influence of it for me. But I have always been mindful of food in general. And I think that's from my mom and my family. They were really into health food and soy milk and kind of the weird stuff. You know, at that time, that was all considered very weird. And we kind of grew up around it. So that informed, I think, that as well, and having an awareness at least of certain things. So I think it's a combination of all of that.
Yeah, I often reflect on my upbringing and dependence on SpaghettiOs, Dunkin' Donuts. All of this is a far cry from my whole food plant-based approach that I take now. And no doubt it was an evolution and not an overnight change. You mentioned something about some of the social pressures and how you pivoted from, let's say, that vegan mindset once you reached college. You grew up in Canada. So do you think you saw or felt a lot of the same social pressures that a lot of American college kids or high school kids face?
Yeah, I mean, I think that experience is pretty universal no matter where you are in North America. I think just going to college, being around new people, partying, drinking alcohol, like getting, like truthfully being a little bit lazier because I lived in residence, I think that just then contributed to my like lazier, like more lackadaisical eating habits. And, you know, if my roommate had frozen chicken fingers, like that was my thing. So I was like, oh my God, I want these frozen chicken fingers. And it's like, I just gave in. And, you know, I probably wasn't eating very balanced leading up to that anyways. And so that's why you end up getting these cravings for meat. And yeah, just the influence of junk food. I mean, that's just very much college, right? The freshman 15, like that whole thing, you become consumed with other things and you put other important aspects of your life aside for that moment. And I guess that's just what happened.
And so what do you think happened in 2009 that pushed you back on the other side of the line?
Right. Well, I had gotten into television and I'd been working in the industry for just a few years. And the 2008 recession happened and I got let go from CTV Globe Media. So that was the parent company. And I lost my job and sort of the rug was pulled out from under me. And I was very unexpected and shocking. And the first time in my life that I had experienced something like that, especially when I was sort of going after what I had always considered to be my absolute dream. And feeling like I had just started getting into it and now this opportunity was just being, you know, taken away from me. So I was in Vancouver, moved back home to Toronto or Mississauga with my family and was pretty down, had a lot of time, obviously, to myself now and was just not very motivated. But what that time did give me, this sort of space was given to me and it just sort of pulled me back into myself. And I just started really paying attention to my mental health, my emotional well-being, and then my physical health. And I was realizing, you know, the way you're eating is not helping any of these things, especially now that, you know, you don't have a job and you're sort of devastated by that. Like, how else can you keep yourself in a good place? And I just went to diet. And that's when I just started paying attention to like how animal products and meat and stuff were making me feel sick. And I just had the time and the space to pay attention to that. Whereas I guess had I have stayed on a kind of hustle trying to make it in broadcasting, I might not have clued in. Again, I might have just put that sort of self-care aspect aside to sacrifice for something else. So I'm kind of thankful for that time because that's where this idea of Hot for Food, like my current business and brand, was born.
Yeah, well, I want to applaud your efforts to bring veganism to the forefront of pop culture. Although science supports the value of integrating this lifestyle nutritionally, socially, and environmentally, it still seems to be controversial, ironically. And I imagine that you hear a lot of backlash from other nutrition-focused communities. How do you manage these criticisms while, I guess, maintaining your sanity? And I'm asking this question purely for myself.
Well, I think because I never had a formal training in nutrition or, you know, this was my own personal journey that I just shared online. And then I had to just sort of listen to myself and also at the same time not be hard on myself. And there's so much information out there and so much contradictory information too about what's healthy and what's not and what's nutritious and what's not. And it gets to be very overwhelming and you start to not even know like what the truth is. So I guess I just decided early on that I was just going to kind of ignore a lot of that, a lot of what I call like the noise in the wellness industry. And again, just like listen, the idea of going vegan was about listening to myself and following those instincts. So when it came to like nutrition or eating a balanced diet or not having a guilt around eating certain foods, well, a lot of that went away by just going vegan because to me, I felt healthier just by eating plant-based foods, whether they were whole foods plant-based or even like vegan junk food, I still felt way better than if I was eating the animal-based products. So I just sort of, decided I was just going to listen to myself and then share my own experience and kind of talk a little bit more about intuitive eating. Again, listening to what you want and like depriving yourself is a whole other problem. So sometimes veganism gets lumped in with this very strict diet culture and health, this idea of health and whole foods and juicing and supplements and just a lot of stuff that sometimes isn't really necessary. You know, it gets lumped in with like this idea of obsessive health culture, like orthorexia. And again, it's all just very complicated and overwhelming. So I just really wanted to distance myself from that. And I didn't want to be another voice that was like telling people what to do, or that there was a certain way to do it.
Yeah, it's interesting what you mentioned about having that awareness of yourself, talking about the intuition and connecting the way you feel with the food that you're eating. I think the key word there is awareness. And too often we fall into the narrative of however we grew up or whatever the social norm is. And that tends to be a big battle. Another point that you brought up is the conflicting science that we have. There seems to be science that supports any type of diet or any type of food. So ultimately, like you said, you have to identify what's most important to you and just step forward. And hopefully, you know, that's the best step, you know, for yourself. And what we see in your videos and what you do is no doubt an extension of your most authentic self. And I think that's part of the reason why so many connect with you. Right now, I'm also thinking about a point that you made about your transition. And I think a lot of people are going through something similar during this current COVID crisis. I hope that people are starting to rethink their approach to health, as all of us should. How do you think veganism will trend in the coming years?
It's hard for me to make predictions. I tend not to do that. But what I do like seeing is the kind of attention that the idea of going vegan is getting because of COVID-19. And I think a lot of people realizing that the way we exist on this planet isn't sustainable, especially the way we use animals for food. And it's just hitting this tipping point that is getting into really dangerous territory that's not sustainable. And there are health risks involved on an individual level and on a global level. So I do like the attention that this pandemic is putting a spotlight on that world, or that idea of eating less meat, a lot less meat. And I think that that's going to last. I think that it's going to have some kind of lasting impact, you know, as a lot of the news is talking about the outbreaks in slaughterhouses and, you know, animals now being wasted because of this. And we should never be put in this situation again. And I'd like to think that this is making an impact on our psyche, on the consciousness of people. You know, on top of that, though, there are many other global issues at hand here. This, of course, isn't the only one. Yeah, so it's hard for me to like say this is what I think will happen. I don't think I have enough sense for the whole big picture, you know, to make a prediction. But there is a momentum, and it comes from different angles, whether it's health or climate change. It's all helpful, and it's all just building to be bigger change. I just try to do whatever I can from this little spot that I occupy, you know, on the planet.
So again, returning to what you've been doing so much now on YouTube with your cooking videos, I'm curious, was there a first moment that you realized, whoa, this is what I was meant to do?
Not when it comes to YouTube, that's for sure. It was definitely this sort of slow evolution. I always wanted to express myself, but I didn't really know why or what I had to say. I do think that what I'm doing now is so much more in alignment with a bigger purpose, because it's kind of for the greater good. Whereas as I started down the road in entertainment television, I think there was some more selfish aspirations in that, you know, wanting to hang out with musicians and get to know my favorite people and that kind of thing. But I still had this deep desire to just share, and I didn't know really what I wanted to say. So it's like now I'm saying something that matters to me. So that feels much more in alignment. But I guess the moment I realized I was kind of meant to be on camera, I guess, or like that I could express myself in that medium, was when I actually went for one of my first television auditions. Was with YTV in Canada. It's a children's sort of Saturday morning show they were auditioning hosts for. And I got very close to getting the job. And I did this when I was in college, and I went to college for music industry business, so it wasn't related to television. It was me and another girl that were up for the job, and it gave me the confidence of like, you know, I don't have any experience doing this. It's just something I've always known I wanted to do or could do. And I had this sort of relentless, almost stubborn ambition for it. And when I got that close, it just gave me the proof that I was meant to do it. Like I just felt if those people saw it in me, with no experience, and they saw, like, I guess, this idea of who I really am coming across on camera, which is not necessarily an easy thing to do, then let me hone in on that. And like, it just let me know that I could get into television and be on camera. So that was, I think, a defining moment. As I moved out of entertainment television, again, it was almost like not up to me, or it felt like it wasn't up to me, because I lost my job again. You know, I lost my job with Bell Media in 2014. And while I had started Hot for Food online and had built a big Instagram following, I was just doing it as a hobby. It was that experience of losing my job again that just forced me through that open door of, like, you just have to do Hot for Food full time, whatever that means. I didn't know what it meant. Was I going to be a full-time blogger? The idea of making videos, recipe videos, hadn't really even occurred to me at that point, and it didn't occur to me for about 6 months. So that seemed very much less planned, I guess. And I didn't really know where it was going, and I just tried to follow the instincts, and it eventually became what you see now.
Yeah, and the thought of creating something fresh and new each week seems daunting. You've even mentioned the pressures of creating new content. How do you maintain your genuine connection to the art and science of cooking while serving the professional need to produce weekly? And what's your process for creating new recipes every week?
Yeah, it is tough, because I definitely feel that pressure of, I established this weekly format and now I feel obligated to deliver. And when I don't, you know, you get the feedback immediately of like, where did you go? I want more video. You know, that's what they want. I set it up myself. I created the template. So that does, you know, ebb and flow, where sometimes I don't feel like doing it, and I do it anyway. I always don't want to let people down, and I don't want to let myself down. I mean, it's a skill that you kind of have to actively do and constantly practice if you want to get better. So I never want to just become lazy with it or think that I know everything, because I definitely don't. And I'm hoping that I'm sharing that discovery of, like, this skill with people, that, like, I do think I'm good and I can offer a lot, but I'm certainly open to learning more. I don't, you know, there's so much more to learn. So I think that's also a motivating factor of, like, I just want to stay sharp. I want to stay skilled. I do want to stay fresh. I don't want my content to be boring or for people to be not excited about a new recipe. So it's something that just sort of flows, or it doesn't flow. When it doesn't flow, I try to just step back from it a bit. Like, I try to just not put the pressure on myself. I get off the device. I get off Instagram. I go on a run, or I go into nature, or I just do something else that's unrelated, because I trust that by doing those things, the creative idea will find me if I just step away for a sec. But when you get all entangled with it and wrapped up with it, and you buy into this pressure, that's when it becomes more straining to come up with ideas. Because sometimes it's like, you're not coming up with them, like, they're finding you. So you have to, like, make space for them to find you.
And you mentioned your writing process for releasing strong negative emotions. Is this a daily ritual? Is this what you just described right now? Would you sometimes sit down and just let your mind flow on paper?
Like journaling? Yeah. It's not necessarily a daily ritual where, you know, I make sure I do it every day. It's just something I do when the feeling strikes, like when I feel like, yeah, I've got a lot of thoughts building up, or yeah, there's just a lot of anxiety, then I do journal it out. And I recommend you do that, but not like read it back. That's not necessarily what you should do. Don't look at it and reflect on it. It's just like a mind dump. It's just to get it out. I do that periodically, but it's definitely not like a daily thing that I force. I don't force it. It's just, if it comes, it comes. And if not, you know, it might be something else that relieves that, like meditation or doing yoga or some other kind of exercise or something.
I recently watched your cooking video with your boyfriend, and I believe he was overseas, perhaps London at the time, and hopefully he's made it back. How do you manage the line between being genuine and sharing too much of your personal self?
Yeah, well, he was in London, Ontario, which is a place that nobody in America would even know about, but it's a smaller town outside of Toronto, Ontario. So he's okay. But yeah, he's still in Canada. Well, this is a hot topic for me because my previous incarnation of my YouTube channel, Hot for Food, involved my ex-boyfriend quite heavily. You know, the reason that I even got onto YouTube for that channel was because I was with him and he was helping me shoot videos. And he was really into cooking and veganism. So we were kind of on that journey together. And I shared a lot of my personal life. And that's how I think that's part of what made me appealing on YouTube at the beginning when I started, is I was really letting people into my life and audiences like that. But as things started to not work out and eventually we weren't together anymore, there was definitely this pullback or this backlash. Both outwardly with the audience and inwardly, where I was like, oh God, like this is the problem with letting people in too much. They've crossed a boundary, but it's your own doing. And I was just very hard on myself because it's not fun to sort of publicly deal with that. I think the fallout of that made me be like, I don't want to do that ever again. But recently, because of I think the situation we're all in and the fact that I've been with this new person a while now and was feeling very comfortable and confident about our relationship, it just sort of, I get this thing where it's like I want to share or just sort of let people in a little bit and see what happens. But it proves to be pretty sensitive. I'm pretty sensitive about it. And I don't think I know what the balance is, Michael. I try things, but I definitely take a lot of criticism personally about my relationship from people who don't know me. The audience doesn't know me fully. And I think they form an opinion about you. And when you don't meet that opinion, then they're heartbroken or they're disappointed or whatever. And like, I don't know. For me, I think that tension comes when I do share that aspect of my life. And I've just recently experienced that by doing those two videos with him. I don't like having regrets, but it's definitely making me reconsider opening up that whole thing online. I don't really have a straight answer for you. It's sort of like something I was playing with, but I kind of am pulling back again.
Yeah, I have always found that, we tend to open ourselves up in different ways depending on the relationship, whether it's with a person, thing, or an experience. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a complete open book. So I think it's okay to set boundaries at different times, especially professionally. And of course, at times you might open yourself up or retract, but it's always a interesting question, what is that line that I'm most comfortable with, especially for someone like yourself that does gain a lot of attention. Just watching your videos, we do get a sense of your most authentic self. And so that I saw those videos before even seeing your boyfriend. So personally, I enjoy more the videos with the cooking than cooking with your boyfriend. And but a lot of people like drama, and so sometimes that's what increases an audience. But yeah, it's always interesting to hear how people dance with this boundary line. And it sounds like for yourself, it's still a thing in question at times.
Yeah, because you don't know what your boundaries are until you've crossed them, I feel like. Does that make sense? Like, at least in my case, I don't know. Everyone likes to talk about boundaries, setting boundaries. And I think that's been part of our thing we talk about in the last couple of years. When we talk about self-care and self-worth, we talk about boundaries. But I'm like, that's not something I ever thought about. I didn't have any boundaries. And to set them is like, I don't know how or where to set them until I've crossed them. Do you know what I mean? Because then you feel that you did that. You're like, oh God. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And when you cross it, it's hard not to beat yourself up if the result isn't exactly what you had hoped. So it definitely it is a challenge, and I don't think there's a best answer to that unless you want to be Kim Kardashian and put your life on a poster, which she has made a lot of money doing that. If that's what she would like, that's fine. But for myself, I'm very introverted as much as I am extroverted. And I do share quite a bit about myself. And my book certainly reflects that. But over the years, I've learned what's most appropriate in different situations. So it's never been a true boundary line across the board. It's been very situational.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is that it can change and adapt, and it is situational. Like the idea of a relationship being shared online, it's like you may feel comfortable in one instance, you know, sharing something, and in another instance not.
Something else that's coming to mind, it's interesting the trap we often get into as a professional, and it's easy to overlook the small successes or even the large ones. How do you remain mindful of your growing audience without succumbing to the pressures of it's never big enough?
That's a hard one too, because you get like this adrenaline rush or this hit when you sort of meet certain milestones or you get certain attention. And something somebody said, and I'm so bad with quotes. I don't know who says this, but you can't believe the negative criticism, but you also can't believe the positive criticism. Do you know what I mean? You have to be neutral toward both, because if you buy into the positive feedback, you're just setting yourself up for disappointment. If you believe your own hype, do you know what I'm saying? Then when you see one bit of criticism, you take it so personally and it hits you in the gut and you think you're a complete failure and that you suck. So I try to remember this. I don't always, but I just try to remember that it's nice to have supporters, and I obviously couldn't do it without them, but I just have to be somewhat careful that I just don't buy into myself and somehow remain humbled and grateful and appreciative. And I think that I do have a bit of this complex about it's not enough, because I'm an achiever. Like, I'm a hard worker, I'm an overachiever. I've just been like that my whole life, and perfectionism goes along with that. And so I judge myself very hard, more than anyone else could. I hope that can soften and sort of dilute as I get a little older. But it definitely brings it front and center when you have kind of a public forum or a public display of what you do. Like, you know, my job's not happening behind closed doors where nobody knows. It's like everybody knows. And I deliberately put it out there. So I'm grappling with it all just a little bit and wondering, how do I keep it in check? And I guess it's just like I have to always just remember to not believe the hype and to come back inward and take care of my inner world and not put a lot of emphasis on the outer stuff.
I think most of us grapple with positive and negative feedback and criticism. And what I've done is try to view any of that feedback or criticism as a signal. Of course, that's easier said than done, just because the emotion that often is tied to whatever we're working on or whatever's being criticized. But like you said, it's tough at times not to get sucked into it, whether it's good or bad.
Yeah. And I try to sometimes see it as a reflection too. It's hard though, because you don't want to put too much weight in it, but you use the word signal, like it's a signal. Like sometimes with social media and YouTube and comments and stuff, and the way I've always viewed my audience is I feel like they are a reflection of me. So if I don't like what I'm receiving, I have to also check myself. I have to be like, well, were you clear about your intention when you posted that video or shot that video? Were you not working in alignment? Were you working from the ego? What were you looking for by posting that? I think that's a lot of the stuff I ask myself when I don't like what I'm getting back in return as a reflection. I try to look at it as a reflection of myself.
I wanted to jump to your cookbook, and I've always been obsessed with the feel of a physical book in my hands, especially the texture of the paper. Of course, it seems as if print is dying with unending streams of online content, or at least digital versions of books. Although you were initially approached with several book offers, you're reluctant to write one. What were the reasons why, and what eventually changed your mind?
Well, going back to how I said I'm stubborn and I don't like doing what everybody else is doing, it was really built in that. It started to look like just anyone and their dog was getting a book deal, and that anyone could write a cookbook, even though it also was like this sort of elusive thing and this big achievement for people. It started because Instagram was so popular, everyone was getting a book deal. Like if you had 100,000 followers, you could get a book deal. So then it just was less special to me, or at least that was my perception. And so I didn't just, again, want to just be another Instagrammer that put out a book. And I tend to look at things very cynically at first. in a lot of ways. And then I kind of come around. So that was just sort of one of those things. And I guess because it was never on my list of goals, like it wasn't something I saw myself doing. So when people kept asking me about it, I was like, no, why would I do that? Because it just wasn't something I ever imagined myself doing. But obviously, as the audience grew and as the popularity of what I was doing grew, and I guess I just had to catch up to myself. It's like that idea, like you just have this resistance. And then when you allow yourself space and you sort of catch up to yourself, you realize you're being stubborn and resistant. And then I realized it just made sense for me to give people what they were wanting. Again, it was a business decision at the same time, like take advantage of your opportunity. Like, why wouldn't you? But I had to just wait for the right opportunity. And I had been approached by some publishers. And after having some conversations, it sort of just felt icky. Like I was like, I don't feel like these people really care about me. Like, again, I'm just another big Instagram account where they sort of realize they can make, you know, they can break even or potentially make more money. And it just took me a while to find the right way to do it that was right for me.
Tell us more about the book. Was there anything different about your cookbook, some type of imprint of you that you wanted to leave for the world?
Well, I think that that's something that comes through when I generalize and say, oh, everyone has a cookbook. It's like, you could look at it that way, but you also have to realize that there's something for everybody. And what you're drawn to isn't necessarily what other people are drawn to. And so we shouldn't really talk ourselves out of doing something because we think everyone else is already doing it. And what could I possibly bring to the table? You know, we deal with this bit of like inner sabotage sometimes, and I do as well. But what I realized as I was making the book is I had to just recognize that everything I touch, like everything I create, obviously is unique to me. And if someone else were to do, something, it would be unique to them. And so I do feel like when you look at the book, it speaks very much to just my style of food, my style of art and creativity and photography, and what people have come to love about Hot for Food and my recipes that I put out. You know, it's not like I was doing something all that different from what was out there. Like there's lots of vegan comfort food books, but I do think that there's just something when you put your all into something and you trust that what you're making is worthy of being made, then it has its own unique imprint that sometimes you can't even describe, that you can't necessarily put your finger on. But I think it's something that can be felt or something that is like sort of resonant, and it's resonant with some people and it may not be resonant with other people, but there are other books for those people too. You know, it's a bit of a vibey way of saying it, but like, it's hard to explain that type of thing, right? Like why a song resonates with someone and not someone else. It's the same thing with any kind of art. And that's really what the book is. And it acts that way. It's a different level than the video content or the Instagram content.
Yeah, I mean, to use music as an example, there are many songs about love, but sometimes it's finding the right voice that you connect to or somehow connects to you. And there could be something else in terms of structure or presentation, but that's part of the reason why we continue to produce cookbooks, different types of self-help or self-improvement books, because it's the voice, the narrative that comes along with it. I often marvel and express gratitude for the paths that I didn't take and the opportunities I turned down that would have dramatically changed the course of my life. Have there been any professional offers that today you're still thankful you didn't accept?
You know, I could have jumped at taking the first book deal I was offered, but again, it came down to sort of a gut instinct and feeling like, I don't know if I can have a good working relationship with this person. I don't know if I just like, even when you're talking on the phone with people, you just have the sense for whether you're vibing or not. And I had a couple of those conversations with smaller publishers at the beginning, and I still grappled with like, oh, but it's my shot. Like, is this my shot? I better take it while I can. But it was actually in saying no to those deals that ended up getting a way better deal and getting a better working relationship with a literary agent as a result. And so that's just a big one where it's like, yeah, if you're impatient or you feel like there are opportunities lacking and you jump at the first one, you're potentially missing out on something even better. And that's hard to decipher, but if you are into instinct like me, I just always have to come back to like, I knew in my gut those weren't the right deals.
Yeah, it's amazing how things tend to work out, especially since you started as a host with MTV and have gone through a number of experiences. You have to wonder, what if you'd never lost those initial jobs? Would you still be in this position today?
Oh, yeah. I think about that all the time. I mean, it's funny how I have two very similar experiences of losing this thing that I thought was my dream job, only to realize it was just, you know, inching me and pushing me to this place, which this is so much more my dream. But I didn't ever dream this specifically, if that makes any sense. So sometimes what you think you want isn't what you really want. Of course, you don't know that till you go through the experiences. I love being, you know, a little older and having the experience of perspective and being able to look back and really see, oh, it really all was working out for me. And then it helps going forward in my life and trusting more. It helps me have a lot more trust in myself and just the path that's unfolding, you know.
I wanted to explore a bit of the psychology of being a host, especially in your early days, and then of course now. When on the screen as an actress, I imagine you might flip the switch to become the character. What process is needed to remain focused as a host when you're especially mindful of every little detail that contributes to that moment?
Mm-hmm. Well, I used to always very much in my brain differentiate myself from an actress. I used to just always almost like dumb down what I did. It's like, oh, I'm just being myself. Like that's, I'm just doing what I do. But there is, hosting is weird because we have so many, I think, outside influences and examples of what TV hosts act like and look like. And I think sometimes that gets in the way of us being ourselves. Like there's like the broadcaster voice. It's like a different voice. And I can see where I did that for a bit. And it took me a while to kind of just like get a little bit more comfortable. But for me, something happens where I'm not really thinking. Of course, you have to remember what you're going to say, but I think it also is about trust, like just knowing yourself well enough, especially when you're live. You know, I did a lot of live television in the last half of my TV career, and it's the most exciting because you can't screw up. But I think the way I came up into television, all of it again was serving me. Like I didn't dive right into doing live. I had a lot of practice doing live to tape and pre-taped stuff that allowed me to get really comfortable with just, I think, being myself. It seems like it would be like, oh, just be yourself, but it's not easy because you think you have to act a certain way as a TV host. And so we put on a little bit of a persona, and I think I did that at the beginning and it was still fine. It wasn't like it was like jarring or bad, but over the years I definitely got way more comfortable and I'm trusting myself, just knowing I was good at what I was doing. And it's like channeling almost too. Like you're just channeling. It's like you know what you have to say. You know how you're going to get from point A to point B to point C with what you're communicating. And it just sort of flows out of you. It's very hard to describe because you're not thinking. Do you know what I mean? As soon as you start thinking, you flub your lines or you stutter or you get in your head. It can't be in your head. But it's certainly a specific type of person, I think, that can do it because your brain is working, like you said, you're thinking about all these little details that contribute to this one moment, especially on live television. Or, you know, I've got this audience of thousands of people watching me, like when I would do the award shows and stuff. It's all blurred out, like it doesn't exist. Everyone always asks me how I do it, and I almost can't explain it.
Well, maybe that's the magic that you're connected to, and the best things in life are often unexplainable. There is something that you mentioned earlier, and it does seem to be a theme, this connection to the self, but specifically, you know, checking in with your intuition. You know, moments like that or post-hosting or creating a new project, what is this process that you used to do a check-in with yourself?
I would say in the last few years anyways, it's definitely connected to like a meditative state where it's like if I know and I can feel like a vibration that I'm connected to while meditating, it carries through in sort of day-to-day tasks and actions. And tapping into that vibration or that alignment, that's where your intuition is. You can hear it better. You're more open to hearing it. And when I know I'm in the right place at the right time or doing the thing that I meant to create or whatever, there's this like inner feeling. There's like this feeling of energy or momentum or vibration, just like something. And it's like a bit of a cue to be like, okay, you're in the zone, like you're in the vortex, you're doing the right thing. Like, don't question it. Like, you don't question it because you're so clear and you have so much clarity that there's no questioning. So I love those moments. Of course, I'm not like that all the time, but I try to just remember what that feels like and know the difference so that I know when I'm creating with intention and yeah, that it's really coming from that, I guess, honest, sort of true place.
And you've mentioned the importance of living with intent in many of your interviews. What are the ways that you direct this energy in your day-to-day life?
I think, you know, when I started meditation, I was being quite deliberate. I was probably writing more in a journal, you know, writing more of a mantra for the day or an intention for the day. But with more experience, it starts to become something that doesn't necessarily need to be so forced. You have to sort of force it at the beginning because it's not a habit. It's not something that you just automatically do. But I would say it's definitely more so now something I kind of automatically do. And it happens in like split second moments in almost an invisible way. Again, this idea of things just sort of flowing to me and or making statements in my mind when I wake up of like how I want to feel. Playing with that energy, I guess, becomes more natural and more of the normal habit. So you don't have to think about it so hard. But I guess for me, that really just came out of a place of meditating or practicing that kind of thing. And I still play with it. Like I still figure it out. But I guess intention is just like knowing what you want and knowing how you want to feel.
That's interesting that you frame it that way, because I think a lot of people would have said in that second part, knowing how to get there or what that path is and not reflecting on their emotion or their connection to it at an emotional level.
I think that's a bit of a misstep. At least I've learned that way, is that you can't really know how you're going to get there. You have to start at the end and work backwards. So if you know how you want to feel or you know where you want to be at the end of your journey, and I'm saying journey meaning like could be the next 5 minutes, it could be the next hour that you're talking to somebody, or you know you're about to create something, so what do you want the end result to be? You just are going to get bogged down with how to get there. And that's the magic that I guess we've been alluding to all along, is that the magic is what happens. It is the how, and it's not necessarily up to you. But if you have the intention from the beginning, and it's usually, yes, based in emotions or a feeling or a sense of how you want your being, the essence you want your being to have, then there's a magic that happens to get there that you're not necessarily in control of. You're only in control of the why, right?
Yeah, and as you're saying this, I'm just thinking about some of the ways that I try to live with intent, and I place in my environment cues and signals to direct my energy unconsciously. And of course, I can't put aside my emotional connection to it. And like you said, it's something that you should never ignore, because that will drive the passion or steer you away.
I like how you're using cues and signals. I think I do that naturally. Signs, whatever. Think reminders, right?
Well, in many ways, it's an extension of the book, The Secret. And so whether or not you believe in The Secret or you know some of the principles that they advocate, there's something to say about seeing something and having some type of mental, emotional connection to it. And not surprising, the more you see something, whether you realize it or not, you might live more aligned with whatever that is. You might take more steps in that direction. For myself, every year, I don't set a list of resolutions. It's a list of intents. And I place this list of intents in the inside of my closet door. So every morning when I wake up and I open the door, I see it. I don't always read it, but it's an unconscious reminder of the things that I've set forth for the year. It is amazing how sometimes you don't realize the steps that you're actually taking, and one day you've achieved that goal or have gotten closer to whatever this intent was.
Yeah, that's what I do. I like the list of intents. I've never written resolutions. I've never liked the idea of that either, because they're a bit hollow and intention is what matters.
No doubt. Well, I just wanted to close out with a couple questions. I have a 3-year-old son, Preston, and I was hoping that you might be able to share one lesson with him. What would that be?
Oh, a lesson. Well, hi, Preston. I think for me, I don't know, I just think back to when I was little, and it was always very important for me to go within. And I guess I had a strong pull to listen to that inner voice. And I would encourage Preston to pay attention to that and to cultivate it and to know that that's like the most important relationship in his life is the one that he has with himself. And that's going to guide him, you know, toward purpose and passion and all the things that he desires. And it's just like, you just want to stay focused there no matter what. A lot of people will pull you in a lot of different directions or give you advice or their own opinions, but really what matters is how you feel and what you intend, and to listen to that voice.
Well, I think that's beautifully said, and I want to thank you so much for being incredibly candid about your path and approaches to life, and you certainly have quite a bit to celebrate. I wish you the most success with your upcoming projects and the best of health for years to come. So where can people learn more about you? Is there anything you'd like them to check out in particular?
Oh, yeah. Thank you for that. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. And I think you're having some interesting conversations on your podcast. So it's nice to see that in the world. Yeah, you can just find me on YouTube. I have 2 channels. I have Hot for Food and one called Lauren Toyota, or Lauren in real life, just my name. And I put content up there every Wednesday on both channels. Book is called Vegan Comfort Classics, 101 Recipes to Feed Your Face. So you can find that on Amazon or wherever books are sold. And I'm pretty active on Instagram. So it's just at Lauren Toyota or at Hot for Food as well.
All right. Well, excellent. And once again, I appreciate your time and being here today. And I hope to talk again soon.
Thank you so much, Michael. It was a pleasure.
If you find this podcast interesting, there are many ways you can support it. You can review the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen on. You can share it on social media with your friends. You can blog about it or discuss it on your own podcast. Or you can read the show notes on michaelmoodyfitness.com. Thank you for supporting the show. Listeners like you make it worthwhile.